Okay, where was I? Now you had a...
Well, I think that you were going on a digression about the character of Fosner as being the romantic of the two giants.
Fossolt,
right. Fossolt and Fafner.
Yeah, he's the romantic one. He's the one that gives the... There's many beauties before this that we haven't discussed in terms of music, but he gives a very beautiful before Logan comes in, very beautiful plea for his love of Freya. Fafner is more mercenary and more desirous of power, and Freya represents that to him. Freya is the one that can give him immortality because of her apples that she produces in her garden that give immortality to those that partake of it. Fafner is interested in that aspect, but Fossil is interested in Freya herself for her beauty. The love of woman, which, as I mentioned before, is to Wagner, the end. That is the great love. And so you got to remember that if you're listening to this opera as a Christian, you've got to reorient yourself into the worldview of the mythology, into the worldview of Wagner. And so that is the ultimate. And Fossil loves the idea of woman. And in particular, the instance of woman to him is Freya.
And yeah, it's interesting that Fossil's aria is one of the greatest arias in the whole opera. Very beautiful. And yeah, yet it also reflects her selfishness. Oh, yeah, right. Certainly not compared to the subsequent ones, but as far as its lyrical quality.
Yeah, it is quite beautiful. And it does reflect his oafishness at the same time. So it's clumsy and beautiful at the same time. And think about that. Think about pulling that out just as a matter of craftsmanship. And it's much more than craftsmanship, but to understand that, to be able to both show the clumsiness and the true depth of it at the same time. And that's what Fossil's little piece does.
Indeed.
So, we're back at, where were we? Where were we in? So,
Well, you went on the digression about Fafner and Fossil because Loke had explained that there was this ring available, but only would be powerful to those that had renounced love. But in the very act of describing it, Fafner's ears have perked up, as well as Votan's. And so you have all these interested parties in pursuing this ring down in the underworld.
That's right, and even Frick is interested in the ring.
Because it would enhance the beauty of her feminine charms.
That's right. To her, it would be... And it comes out later. She says, could this ring keep a husband at home, basically? Could it keep him enamored with his wife? Which, as we're going to learn, is one of the issues with Wotan. He's a typical pagan god who is a roaming god. And so she's interested in the hearth and the home, and in particular, her own hearth and home. And she's wondering if this ring could keep her husband from wandering. So, basically, all of the principals are interested in the ring as soon as they hear about it. For different reasons.
Pure genius.
Fricka for keeping her man at home, enhancing her beauty, being an adornment to her. Wotan for continuing his project of ruling the world, and yet, of course, he's not going to renounce love. And Fafner, who's an instrumentalist, who is very much like Albrecht, who is only interested in in power, but not just power of dominion of the world. Well, I shouldn't say just, I shouldn't use the word just, but he's not so much as interested in dominating the world. He's interested in pure being, pure continuation. Not so much domination, but to live as a God without the threat of change, the threat of dominion of his personal life, his personal immortality. And of course the other gods are interested in various levels that Wagner doesn't probe, but it's implied that everybody is interested. The only one that's, oh, I shouldn't say the only one, the only two that are really immune from the power of the ring are Loga and Fossolt. Fossolt has decided upon Freya. That is, the love of woman is what he wants. And Loga comes as an ambassador of the Rhine Maidens, basically thinking that he has a solution to everybody's problems, particularly Votan's problem. How is he going to pay for this? He's going to pay for this by buying off the giants with the gold, which the ring can produce. The ring brings power, and with it, wealth. So he can buy off the giants with the loot, and at the same time, restore the ring to the Rhine Maidens so that they can go back to this age of innocence.
Well, maybe to clarify that point, you should point out that there was more gold than just the ring.
That's right. The Rhine gold brought about the ability ultimately to rule the world, but the way in which it's going to rule the world is through wealth, basically.
Well, but I mean, Loge must believe that the giants can be bought off with the bulk of the gold minus the ring.
That's right.
And so the ring can somehow be returned to the Rhine Maidens, although he may have a bit of double-mindedness of trying to lure Votan into wanting to go for the ring. But in any case, he seems to think that the giants can be bought off with the gold minus the ring.
Right, and then that would pay for Valhall. The ring would go back to the Rhine Maidens, and everybody will, you know, go to the status quo ante, right? I mean, just before everything would be paid for, and everybody would be happy. And so he is an advocate of
utilitarianism.
That's right. Everybody's going to be settled with his plan. So Fafnir says, you know, I'd be willing to take, instead of Freya, the gold, the Rhine gold. And Votan's comeback is what you would expect. You know, how can I give you that which is not mine? It's not my gold. I can't give you the ring. It's not mine. The gold is not mine. And Loga has a solution. And the solution is very simple, that you take the ring and the gold from Albrecht. Now that, he reasons, would not break Votan's the covenant nature of his rule, because he wouldn't be disestablishing the order. Because it is not breaking the order to steal from a thief. Albrecht is a thief, so he could steal from a thief.
Well, is it that he wouldn't break the order because stealing from a thief, or just because Albrecht is not part of the covenant order?
Both. I think the order, it's not only that Albrecht hasn't entered into the covenant, but I do think in a sense he has. And everything, if he's going to rule all the world, which includes all the races, then he in a sense has established a covenant with them implicitly. So the main thing is that if somebody has stolen something, then to steal from that person is not to disestablish or destroy the covenant order of things.
Except that that's kind of a Talmudic idea. I mean, I shouldn't say except for. I mean,
Well, yeah, but all...
It's orthogonal to what Wagner's trying to do, but...
Right, I mean, but all the non-Christian views are ultimately Talmudic. Hmm. And so that's what we have in Wagner here. So...
I mean, I would rather explain it kind of with the double-mindedness of Votan, though. I mean, he's kind of sneaky. Thinks he can steal it and not violate his covenant. But
well, but we're getting there because he rejects that at first. He rejects that opera. I mean, he rejects that option. And so Freya begins to plead with him. Fricka pleads with him. The other gods plead with him. And so he basically finally relents.
Well, you might add that one huge motivation is that they all feel like death is approaching because they're missing their golden apples.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. Let's stick to the plot and we'll be on steadier ground. So the giants finally have enough of the babble, enough of the talk. And so they leave and basically say, you know, by sundown we're coming back, and you either give us Freya or the gold, and that's the deal. And so they take in earnest Freya with them. And so after Freya leaves, the gods, because of the absence of Freya, have not had their apples. And so they begin to weaken and begin to lose their sheen and their radiance. Loga's not that influenced because he comments that Freya was niggardly with the apples for him. He's never on the same order as... He's a demigod. He's never on the same order as the other gods, and so...
Only one apple per month for you.
Yeah, it's not something that's going to affect him greatly. But the other gods begin to feel it immediately. And so they began to circle the wagon and say, look, you know, we're going to lose everything. We're going to lose our immortality without Freya. And so, for these reasons and other reasons, Votan finally agrees to going down and grabbing the ring. So this is all happening. So the giants leave with Freya. Votan eventually agrees to go down to Nibelungenheim and get the Rheingold from Albrecht. And so their end is the transition from scene 2 to scene 3. And the transition, by the way, is a marvelous transition.
Mm.
Because remember, the curtain never goes down, and the orchestra is playing some very rhythmic music. And in the midst of it arises the sound of anvils, and Wagner commissioned that there would be anvils made in different pitches to make this transition. And so you hear in the background of these transition from scene 2 to scene 3, as they're descending from the mountaintop to Nibelungenheim, the realm of the dwarfs underneath the earth, that these anvils would be hammered out. And there's actually anvils that are being hammered on.
It's unbelievable music. Totally unique and pulled out of thin air by Wagner. That I think is still unique to this day. And you have to hear it to believe it.
Yeah, I mean, there's... I don't know how many anvils are there. There's at least 7, but I don't know what the number is, but...
I mean, it really captures whatever genius or goodness in rock music that you could identify, Wagner already anticipated. Just that rhythmic pulsation. And you wish that that particular transition motif could last for 5 more minutes, but unfortunately it ends all too quickly.
But it comes back, in the ascent, it comes in again.
That's right.
You hear it, you do get to hear it again.
That's right. But it's amazing.
So, law, there's two, and the, one of the bits of humor, there's a lot of humor here that we're missing, but one of the humorous pieces is that there's two ways down to Nibelungenheim, and one way is by means of the Rhine, which Wotan wants to skirt, wants to avoid, because he doesn't want to hear the pliant wails of the Rhine maiden, which he's going to hear at the end of the opera anyways. But he don't want to avoid that, and so there's another way, and so they take that way. And so you hear the music of the anvils. And so they finally get down there. Now we're into scene three. And down there they first discover, not Albrecht, but the brother of Albrecht, who is called Nima. And he's going to make his appearance later on in the ring cycle in Act 3. We'll get to that later. But Nima is the brother of Albrecht, who has been enslaved, like all the other dwarfs, by Albrecht because of the power of the ring. Albrecht has enslaved all of the other dwarfs to himself as his slaves in order to delve for gold. And so that's what all the dwarfs do. But Mima is commissioned to make a chainmail helm called the Tarn Helm, which the ring has given Albrecht insight into how to make it, but the skill to make it is possessed by Mima, so he tells Mima to make it. But Mima doesn't know what it's for and what it does. Basically what it does is grant the user of it the ability to change shape, to transform himself to different places and locations. But he doesn't understand what it is. That is, Mima doesn't understand what it is. And so he gets down, so the Wotan and Loga get down into the underworld, and they find all the dwarfs enchained and in a place that Wotan mentions a bunch of place of joy. You know, the dwarfs say that they once used to fashion their wares for the joy of their wives. Again, the theme of love for woman comes out throughout the first opera. And now it's a place of slavery and bondage. They're bound to one man in his will, or to one being in his will. And so Mima kind of personifies all of them. He is bound to make this artifact that he himself does not take delight in. He doesn't even know what its powers are. And so they go down there and they query, Loga and Wotan query Mima. And he basically tells them what has gone on there. And Wotan comments on how a sad, you know, what used to be a joyful place has become a sad place. And so Wagner is always developing his characters. I mean, Wotan is a very complex character. He's one of the great characters in all of opera. And in fact, one of the great characters in all of literature.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that.
And so he understands the loss of it's not just intellectual. He understands another level, at other levels, the loss that the dwarfs have had. And so Albrecht comes eventually on the scene, scares everybody off, scares Mima off. He takes the Tarn Helm from Mima. We don't see him again until the first act of Siegfried. So Albrecht comes in and begins to have a discussion with Wotan and Loga. Now, it's a very odd discussion because you have, in a sense, alter egos. There's only one other time in the opera, and that's in Götterdämmerung, that Albrecht and Wotan interact with one another. But as I said, they're in many ways alter egos. And so they interact with one another, and Wotan and Loga together start to query Albrecht, and they ask him about the ring, and Albrecht is very secure in it and said he's going to, with the ring, produce more gold. He has his minions, his underling dwarfs, continuing delving for gold, and he's going to, with the gold, buy more power. You know, like out of The Godfather, right? By selling narcotics, you're going to gain more power. and eventually you can control more and more. And so that's what he's going to do. He's going to gain power of the world through this will.
Maybe not now, maybe not tomorrow, but in 5, 10 years.
That's right. 10 years from now, 100 years from now, he's going to gain power of all things. And now there's something absurd about Albrecht. He's obviously somebody who is not... He's somebody that obviously is not going to gain control of the world. But he shows the threat. He shows the type of thing that is a threat. It's not the threat that Albrecht is going to really take over the world. But
why do you say that? Because of a fundamental incompetence?
Yes. I mean, Albrecht is not that type, but it's the type of world that... It's not the threat of Albrecht's reign. It's the threat of what the world can become when Albrechts take over the world. In other words, the world is ultimately going to become populated with Albrechts. And that's my reading of it. It's not that Albrecht himself... I mean, Albrecht is the threat in one sense, but you really can never take Albrecht as a serious threat per se. Now, his son is different. I mean, Hagen, who comes in the last opera, is in many ways different from his father and more sinister than his father because he has a different bloodline, which is another area that we need to discuss, the issue of race and bloodline, but we'll get to that hopefully later on. So anyways, they get into this discussion and he talks about what he's going to do, his plans, and then Logan begins to question about, well, what about this ring? I mean, what about, are you afraid that somebody could steal it or somebody could come in and overthrow you and by means of stealth? And he then talks about the Tarnhelm, that he has had it created, the Tarnhelm, and he reveals what the Tarnhelm is, which we already talked about. That is, can make you change shapes, appearances, make you move from one location to the other. In other words, by wearing this Tarnhelm, it can make him something that's invisible, something that is seemingly omnipresent. And so that is what's going to protect him and the ring from outside forces. And so here we have now a Puss in Boots story, if you're familiar with the fairy tale Puss in Boots. And so Loga tricks him, who he's like, as I said before, he's the god of tricks. He says, well, you know, what can you do with this thing? Is this Tarnhelm really all that it's cracked up to be? And so, like somebody who is puffed with pride, Albrecht takes the bait. And so...
Shouldn't we dwell on that for just 10 seconds? I mean, to say that Loki understood Albrecht's pride as being a more fundamental force than even his lust for pleasure or power. And in typical Logian fashion, exploited it instantly.
Right, and that's why, I mean, that's in a sense, well, that's in one way, one reason I would say that Albrecht himself isn't the threat. That rather, the threat is the world becoming populated with Albrecht-type people. In other words, the whole world becoming debased like Albrecht.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, Albrecht is carried easily away from his pride. He really isn't simply interested in ruling the world, he wouldn't be subject to those types of silly tricks and questionings of his querying of his authority and of his power. But he is. He's taken by it, and so he becomes first of all a great dragon. You know, can you turn yourself into a dragon? Great dragon. Ha! Nothing simpler. So he turns into a great dragon. And Loga cowers, or at least pretends to. And Votan, in the midst of this, this is one of the great things about it. Votan, in the midst of seeing Loga cowering, which is not just I don't believe it's completely feigned. There's some genuine cowering in it. Votan's on the side just... in his divine way, laughing at the whole scene. Ha, 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 ha. And so, Hagen changes himself back into his normal form, and very proud of himself, and Loga is...
You mean Albrecht?
Albrecht changes himself back into his normal form, and Loga is panting, and he said, oh, you know, you scared me. I thought you were going to devour me, basically. And he says, well, I guess that seemed easy for you, but can you seem to do something more difficult? Can you turn yourself into something small? And Albrecht, not seeing the trap set before him, nothing simpler. Nothing simpler. So he puts on the Tarn helm and turns into a frog. Well, Loga and Votan, who is cued into Loga at this time, then simply pounce upon Albrecht the frog and capture him.
They throw the net around him.
And they capture him. And he is caught. And so that ends the third scene. And so the transition from the third scene to the fourth scene is them coming down from the underworld back up to the mountaintop. And again, you have the anvils coming out. A great transition again. And so you're back in scene four, back on the mountaintop with Albrecht, who is bound by cords or a net, and Loga and Votan standing over him. And no longer is Loga the subject of Albrecht's threats, which in scene three he was, but now he is in a different position. It's a reversal. And so they demand of Albrecht to be, in order for his freedom, that he give a ransom. And so the first ransom is that he brings the loot, the gold. And so Albrecht, by means of the power of the ring, calls his minions up from the depths, and they bring up the gold that they had delved from the earth. So the power, the wealth that, and the power that it can bring forth. And then Albrecht, Loga at this time is satisfied, but not Votan. And Loga goes along with it, wants a Tarnhelm. And Albrecht, who is singing, but to himself, right? I mean, this is one of the great things about opera. You can sing publicly, but only divulge your inner feelings, not to the other characters, just speak to yourself, is divulging that, okay, well, what is it for me? You know, he doesn't want to give up the Tarn helm. It's a bad weapon to put in the hands of his enemies, but with the power of the ring, he could fashion another one, and he could always get more gold with the ring. He could make another Tarn helm, so it's not completely disastrous. And so he gives up the Tarn helm.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like in a Risk game that you might have to give up Asia, but if you can just keep Australia.
That's right. You can
then later you'll beat it back out again.
You can rebuild it. And then Votan demands the ring. He sees the ring and demands that as well.
Is that right, or is it the giants that demand it?
No, Votan does. Votan demands it.
Oh, right.
And...
Yes.
And Albrecht, in one of the great speeches of the whole ring, says that, you know, to give you the ring is to give you more than myself. It's to give you myself. This is myself. And he refuses. But he's not in a position to refuse. And so Votan forces the ring from him. He steals the ring from him. And at this point, Albrecht makes his curse, which really gets the rest of the cycle going.
Right.
He curses the ring, the bearers of the ring. Anybody that bears the ring will die from it, and those around him will be affected by the curse. And it's basically going to be destruction and mayhem for anybody that is involved by intentional or even unintentional means with the ring. Now you got to understand that Wagner is using mythology, but mythology is tapping into something that's really primal and mysterious, and in a sense very biblical, because we today think of words as things you do things, as things that are vehicles of propositions. In other words, they're just words are just something that holds other things. They don't do things. But in the world of fairy, and in the biblical world, words do things. You know, remember at the beginning of Genesis, God speaks, but his words aren't communicating. At least that's not the primary function of it. His words are doing things. And Votan's curse is a very real thing. It doesn't just hope that bad things happen.
You mean Albrecht's curse?
Albrecht's curse, I'm sorry. Albrecht's curse. Albrecht's curse doesn't hope bad things happen to the bearers of it, but it makes bad things happen to it.
Well, it reminds me of the proverb that says something to the effect of the curse lightly given, or I forget the exact words, but the curse lightly given or the curse improperly based passes away like the wind of the air, or something like that. There's a proverb that I can look up later. But the implication there is that the properly grounded curse should be taken seriously.
That's right, because it's all based upon God, and God's words are not just vestibules or vehicles or propositions, but they're things that do things.
Exactly. That's what covenant means, I think. Covenant means a word that brings something to pass, but that's a whole other topic that we can discuss some other time.
And so Albrecht's curse does something. It's not just a, would that bad things happen to you? But bad things are going to happen. So you have to take that as a given. You know, apart from the theological discussion, you have to take that as a given in the opera. And so now Votan has the ring and is enamored by it. He's smitten by it. Now, he seems to have the sweet deal on one level for a moment in his mind. He has the ring, which is going to give and consolidate all of his power, but he doesn't have to renounce love in the process. But this is an illusion that he has, because the giants quickly come back. Albrecht slips from this. He doesn't. We don't see him we see him in Siegfried again. So we have to wait another two operas to see him again. But he slithers away. Apparently defeated. And Albrecht himself, in a sense, is defeated, but what Albrecht stands for is not defeated. In the principles, in the system that he stands for. And so the giants come back, the rest of the gods come back, and they're ready to make the deal now. You know, bring us the gold, and we'll give you Freya. And so, is not really desirous of giving up Freya. He's doing this half-heartedly because his brother has basically convinced him of it. And so he says, "But I will not give her up unless, you know, you cover her up with gold." And so they place staffs in the ground and Freya between them, and you have to cover her with gold. And so Votan is utterly disgusted with this. And so Loga and I think it's
that's such a great primal image. I mean, there's nothing greater than that image.
Get the cheapening of the whole transaction. And so Logan and Donner or Fro, I forget which one, begin to stack the gold up, the loot up. And so they cover her up completely. Except for one portion of her can be seen. And Fassel just cannot give her up because he could still see her. Now, this is obviously a plot device, but it's also something that's very primal as well, because
indeed,
until the image of the woman can be erased from his mind, he can't give her up. He just cannot let her go. And so they see another trinket there, the Tarnhelm. Now, Votan is loath to give this up and refuses at first, but eventually realizes that the giants are resolute and they won't do it. And so he cannot simply go against them. Again, the covenant issue. He cannot break his covenant. So, and he cannot give up Freya either. And so he agrees to give up the Tarnhelm. So they throw it on there. The deal is done, except Fossholt captures a gleam of Freya's eyes. Now, this is something that, again, seems like a plot device, but it actually is something that's important throughout the rest of the opera. I eventually plan to write an essay on it, but the eyes are something that are very important to Wagner, very important to human beings. You know, Shakespeare said the eyes are the windows of the soul. And the eyes are what captures the essence of humanity. And so the eyes, the gleam of one's eyes, plays a very pivotal role throughout the whole holdering cycle. And here you see it the first time. So you have Fossil capturing the gleam of Freya's eyes. And unless that gleam can be covered, he cannot give her up. Now there's no gold. The Tarnhelm is gone. So what could possibly cover it up? Well, of course, that's going to be the ring itself. Now, Votan refuses. He's willing to give up Freya and all that that is going to result in. He is not going to give up the ring. He is enamored with it. And then all of a sudden, the primordial force of the earth appears, and that is Erda, which is the German for earth, the goddess Earth. She arises, and in a music that is, I use a lot of quotidian pedestrian ways of expression, but it's, I don't know of another way of expressing it. It's very primal coming out. It's very primordial. She comes up out of the earth, and it is the earth speaking. It is the wisdom of that which is before all the order. Votan represents the ordering of the world, but she is that which is primeval. She exists before that, and she is the wisdom that is primeval. She's not the ultimate wisdom, as we're going to see later on, but she is a certain type of wisdom that at this point Votan does not possess. And she comes in haunting music. The first time you hear it, you may not appreciate it, but give it a few times, and it is very moving and powerful. She comes in and basically tells Votan that, teaches him wisdom about the structuring of the world and the order of things, and that ultimately he needs to renounce this thing. This is not what's important, ultimately. He needs to give it away. And so Votan, to his great credit, I mean, Votan is a very, very compelling character. In fact, you know, I really don't know in all literature anybody that is, to me, as compelling as a Votan. He's very complex. And so Votan gives up the ring. He covers up the gleam of Freya's eyes, and so the giants take away the gold and the ring and the Tarnhelm. I'll finish that story in just a moment. So Erda does this, and Votan, in the meantime, is captivated by Erda. He's captivated by that which he does not have. He's going to say in the next opera that what fascinates him is that which he does not understand, that which has never been, that which is a possibility but hasn't been, to use Aristotle's language, actualized. Those are the things that he is interested in. And Erda represents that to him. He doesn't really have even earthly wisdom at this point. He is a very young god. He is a powerful being and has some wisdom compared to the giants and the dwarves, certainly. but he doesn't even have primordial wisdom. And so he's captivated by Erda. And so that's going to play an important role. In fact, it's going to be really a determinative role in the rest of the opera. Now, in the meantime, the giants take the lute. And Fossolt, the one who is the more human of the giants, his heart is rent. He got the payment, but he's still desirous of love for the woman, love of Freya. And so Fafnir is hauling the lute to himself. And when Fossil comes to his senses, he sees that Fafnir has taken most of it. And so Loga comes to him on the sly, the god of the trickster, and says, Fossil finally realizes what's happening, and he's getting upset by it. And Loga comes to his ear and says, well, don't worry about that. You can get as much of that as you want. Just take the ring. Grab the ring. So he goes to grab the ring, and Fafnir claims that it's his. So you have the beginning now of the curse of the ring, because there's a fight between the giants. Fassholt asks Votan to mediate between them, and Votan wipes his hands of the whole ugly affair. Votan is both very, you can call him very Jewish and sharp, but also one who sees beyond the mundane. But he's not going to get involved in their dispute. That's something that is beneath him. And so they end up fighting, and Fafnir kills Fossolt over the ring. So the curse of Albrecht begins almost immediately with the death of Fossolt, and Fafnir is the last now of the giants. And so there is kinslaying at the very beginning of this. Very biblical in some sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so Fafnir takes everything for himself and is gone, takes it all with him. Now we'll see Fafnir in the third opera. The interesting thing about the ring cycle is the ring doesn't ever come directly into focus in the next opera at all, in Die Walküre. It's not until the third opera that the ring explicitly comes into play again. But it's all in the background of Die Walküre, so you got to understand that. So Fafnir kills Fassel, takes the ring, and now Valhall has been paid for. Now we come to the climax has come, which I would consider to be Erda and the decision that she precipitates in Votan. That's the climax. And now with the denouement comes, which is a glorious one. Votan is troubled, and all this has transpired. And he recollects now Valhall. Now Valhall is his, bought and paid for. Freya is free, and the gods can now enter in their bliss. And so in very glorious music, you have the reintroduction of the Valhall theme in its most glorious form now. Now, if you're not familiar with the opera, you're just going to have to hear it to know the theme. But it's a glorious Valhall theme that goes throughout the whole cycle. And in fact, it really is there's three themes at the very end that culminated. And it's one of those three themes that it's weaved in with two others at the very end. But the Valhall theme is played in its most glorious way, where the gods now are going to enter in triumph into their fortress. Now they are securely in place. Votan says, Folge mir, Frau, in Valhall, Donna with Mitmir. Follow me, wife, into Valhalla. Live there with me. Reign forever. And she wonders about the name, and he tells her that the name will be established by the deeds that he will perform, and it will become apparent to her. And glorious music is transpiring through all of this. Now, I'm skipping a lot of the great music. I mean, in the meantime, Donner has gathered, there's a storm that gathered. He gathers the storm clouds together, clears the sky, and Fro creates a rainbow bridge into it. Beautiful, beautiful music. And so, in epic, godlike way, they're entering into their era of blessedness, dominion. Except for one thing. And that is, in the background, off stage, you hear the pliant wails of the Rhine Maiden. And the Rhine Maiden are calling out for the Rheingold. And in beautiful music, they're crying for Rheingold, Rheingold, purest gold. You know, and they want it. Not because they want to possess power, but in their, remember, they're the primordial beings, like Erda, and they want it for, not for anything that's going to give them other than beauty and pleasure. And frivol, it's just the joy of it that they want. And it's theirs, they claim. And Votan tells Loga basically to get those accursed nymphs away, shoot them off. And, Loga's not able to do it. And so they enter into Valhall from a beginning that was glorious, and yet now it has what? It has this unsettling undertone to it. There's something wrong. There's something that has not been established permanently. There's something that has been polluted. And Logan, a beautiful little soliloquy, wonders what he should do. He says, I should just turn myself into fire, turn everything into fire, consume everything, and have done with it. What will I do? He doesn't decide to do that. But he introduces, again, the chorus there, and the frivol, the utter vacuousness of the god's achievement. The music is great and grand, and it should be taken that way. In the pagan mythologies, there is some greatness to it. There's some grandeur of it. And yet it is ultimately hollow. And Loga introduces that. Wagner, just in a genius way, shows both the grandeur of it, and you're taken by it. And at the same time, you see right through it, because you get Loga's perspective. And Loga basically is telling us that this is all in vain. What should, we might as well end it right here. This is all utterly vain. And so that's how the opera ends. And so what we've had is the story now of the ring and what it's going to do and what the possibilities are. Now we'll take a break and we'll go to Dvalkyra after the break. But Dvalkyra is the second opera, but it also, it's not just it's a second in terms of sequence, but it fills some backstory behind even Das Rheingold. It gives us some things that went before it. And so, in many ways, Die Walküre is the pivotal opera in the whole cycle. So when we come back, we'll talk about how the plot thickens, but also how the plot has become more elaborated, and how the creation myth is brought into it, and how all the different themes that have been introduced in Rheingold are further elaborated and deepened. So we'll do that after a break.